Accession number 13359, Mr. George Richardson, reel 14.
Mr. G.S. Richardson, Reel 14. You were talking about the medical corps people who went in after the wounded patrol.
Yes, well, we saw this Royal Army Medical Corps ambulance come over the escarpment and go down into this valley, pick up a couple of badly wounded DLI men from the previous night's patrol, and he brought them in. The Germans had been shelling around about the ambulance, but they never hit them. And they stopped shelling them, I think, while they picked them up. And then they started shelling them just to show that they were around. But the ambulance got back out safe with the two men. And later on we heard that within 2 or 3 days an RAMC driver had been awarded the MN, and probably his attendance together with him, probably mentioned in dispatches. But it was an award that he well deserved, because he volunteered to do it. They were there lying in between our lines and the German lines, and the nearest that we could have done was wait until the next night and send a plutonium for them, and they probably would have died.
How important was it to you to know that medical aid was close?
Oh, we always relied on them. If we're going to get wounded, well, at least our RAMC is with us. And the RAMC were our own, our 50th Division, because the whole of makeup of the 50th Division was to be a full military division with its own everything in it. Nobody depended on any other unit outside, because we were a self-contained infantry division, like everybody, I suppose, any other infantry division. But we always worked closely with each other. We always corresponded with each other on telephones and everything else. So, yes, the forward medical aid units were as close as they possibly could out of shell range. Our RAP, our regimental aid post, was always just behind the line. Our MO was just behind the line. He was there, ready to deal with anybody. Any casualties had to get dealt with, they dealt with them, and there was never a short of stretcher bearers to go and take wounded men back.
What did the Alamein line actually look like, particularly the section you were in?
Well, in the section that we were in, we'd finished up on part of an escarpment. There wasn't a lot of action going on, except at night time. And then at night time, our guns would be mostly long-range guns firing over the top of our heads to German positions, German long-range guns answering our artillery back. Now and again, Stokers would come over and strafe our lines and send bombs down. The Desert Air Force, I remember, we had to lay some oil markers out 2 or 3 nights to show where our forward positions were. And at a given time, they had to light these oil cans of oil, and the Air Force would come over and take the position of that line and know that they had a bomb just in front. That action in front of our line often happened during that time. But I think that was more or less a static position of the line that was getting close to the way we had been up in Gazala, where our engineers were putting mines out in front of us, and I don't think we were in boxes. We were more or less in the straight, or near as straight as Dammit Lane, right way through to the coast. And as far as I can ascertain, then we were probably 25, 30 mile out from the coast, the south end of the line, in our brigade position.
We were dug into small bunkers?
Slit trenches. I was never one for digging. I didn't like digging. I've been saying too much of mine. If we got to our heads and shoulders below, that was enough for me. 2 or 3 feet down. Some of the desert was very hard. Some of it was very soft. Surface sand used to drift a lot, but underneath the surface sand was hard. But our positions for a week or two gradually became more and more action.
What happened next, Mr. Richardson?
Well, it was getting towards the 20th of October, and things started happening down at the other end of the line. We heard a lot of bombardment going off and a heck of a lot of flashes in the sky, both from the German side and our side. And then we got messages from General Montgomery, 8th Army Commander, telling us that the Battle of Alamein was about to begin and to go forward and beat the Jerry's back.
Had you seen him before this? Had he come to see you?
Oh, yes. He'd been up in our lines 2 or 3 times.
What impression did you get of him?
Well, we thought he was a little bombastic bloke running around with a tank or hat on when he's a general, you know, running around the tank and waving his stick around the new men, gather around and are you all being treated all right and are you ready to face the enemy, things like that. Now, that common question was as I was concerned. But he came in the lane. That's the main thing. I mean, he wasn't very far behind.
Did he have the effect of lifting morale?
At first, we found out the difference between him and the our General Auchinleck that had been in command for him. Our beer rations and cigarette rations were cut down. And we'd heard that he wanted guns and ammunition and not supplies of, cigarettes and things being brought, which I suppose made sense. But after all, you've got to keep the morale of your troops up, and if they're getting poor quality cigarettes, and some of them, Camels, that were the one of Camels, they were made of Camels, but they were mostly imported from India, and our beer was imported from India. We did get one or two bottles now and again that was specially brewed for us from Canada, Black Horse beer. Ooh, it was nearly as strong as whiskey. It was fortified with spirit so it could stand the heat. And one bottle of that and you thought you'd drunk a double whiskey. But we didn't, that was few and far between. The supplies of like that had been cut down. And we blame Montgomery for wanting nothing else but ammunition to come out and not our comforts. Anyway, we didn't think much of him. Later on, we thought a little less of him, but we'd known that he was doing a good job as an army commander, especially after the Alamein battle, when we broke the line. And I thought, well, okay, he's done a good job as army commander. He's putting a good move on.
Had your equipment improved?
Yes. Our signal officer, for one thing, had been previously a signal officer, and he'd give us a lot of training in wireless signalling that we hadn't done in the past. The new sergeant that we had a lot more experience and in the more modern equipment than what we had been using. And I think Sammy Watson, because he had been headquarters company commander, wanted to use the headquarter company personnel to better use than what Battiscombe had. Battiscombe was one of the old brigade that thought of nothing else but straight line, bayonet charge, everything forward and then dig in. And that was more or less his training, and he'd probably seen nothing else. He didn't have the modern technique of a CO that he should have had. And I think that's where our signals in overtime didn't do the job properly right through the first half of the war. I'm confident of that. We did later on, but we had better training. Anyway, we went from the southern end, we were pulled out. We were replaced by, I think, some Indian troops, and we were marched down, and this was after the main attack had already taken place. After the 23rd of October, we were getting towards the end of October, and the line hadn't been broken. We knew that two brigades of the Highland divisions had been in action and had suffered heavily, and they hadn't gotten any further than the FDLs of the Germans, forward defence lines of the Germans, and lost a lot of casualties. So they took us down 2 or 3 miles behind the line, close to the coast end. There, November the 1st, we were assembled just behind the line. And then as dusk came, they moved us right forward to the forward defence lines of the Highland Division lines. We'd been told that we're going in to attack and break the line. We're being told that we had advanced 2,500 yards. Our battalion that was on the right flank. We had advanced 2,500 yards. Our right flank had to be turned round and dig in. Our 8th battalion to the left, our 9th battalion to the left of them. There was a battalion of Australians going to advance as we were advancing to dig in. And the few hundred yards that were left from our line to the coast, they were going to cover that. There was both of guns with fixed lines of fire set up, and they were firing off and on, off and on, off and on, in straight lines to get their straight lines in the line of advance. There were straight lines on our right flank, and to the left of our brigade, there were straight lines. And then the 152, who were being in reserve of the Highland Division, they hadn't done any action. They were moved at the same time as us. To the left of them, I think, was the New Zealand Battalion, had been told to follow up and dig in to preserve the flanks. Now, in that action that we had done with the Composite Battalion, we had no cover on our flanks. And it was because of that that I think that the cut off round, and I captured or killed most of our battalion was strong, about 600 men at the end. Anyway, there was full brigade, and we were told to move forward, and at 1 o'clock was our start time. Just before all night, the Desert Air Force had been going over and bombarding. Long range heavy artillery had been bombarding over the top of us in front. Our artillery moved up close behind us. We were told that we had advanced 2,500 yards at 100 yards per minute, that our artillery would advance with us at 100 yards a minute, firing a creeping barrage 100 yards in front of our forward line, and we had to keep at that space. Our intelligence section went forward, one with each company, with a stopwatch and markers and white tape, marking the line of advance and the same time. We had two wireless sets tuned in to all our wireless sets in each of our companies. I think I was with B Company, And at 1 o'clock in the morning, the sergeant majors blew the whistles. The artillery barrage had been going on some while, and the artillery barrage started lifting because they were only just in front of us.
Prior to that time, whilst you were waiting, lined up.
About an hour or more.
Dark night.
Yes.
Lots of noise. What were you feeling like?
Oh, terrible. Terrible. I think I sang my prayers more than once. And I actually tried to sleep. I always found that just before, you never know when you're going to get to sleep again. Try and get some sleep, George. And I lay back with my head in my helmet, and these 2,000 guns are rattling over the top of us. And heck of a rattle. And I was stupefied. We'd been given our double tot of rum, and the whistles blow, and we started advancing. And we were in full communication, and the advance was going well. We advanced a few hundred yards.
Where were you in relation to the rest of the company you were with?
Oh, I was more or less in line.
You were with
company,
the front?
The infantry platoons were in front, but company headquarters, company commander advancing up in line.
You were with the company commander?
With the company commander, because he had his own little runners between platoons. And my job was to communicate between the company commander and battalion headquarters.
Do you remember who the company commander was?
No, I can't. I can see the sergeant major in the eye, and I can't even think of his name that went forward with this. Anyway, we started advancing, and our orders were that we had showed it. Not me, but the troops had to shoot into every slit trench. We were told not to get down, because if you get yourself into a slit trench or a shell hole, you'll be killed by your own men. You had to keep on advancing at 100 yards. And our artillery, and there was quite a few of our own artillery shells fell among us, and all that, because it gave with the direction they're coming from. 25 pounds falling short, and shrapnel wounding or killing our own men. So I went forward. And I think by 3 o'clock we'd come to our advance, and we'd swung round and I'd dug a hole. We dug in, and some of our troops were round to the front of us and some to the sides of us. Couldn't move far. And all night we were being bombarded back, but our artillery moved along up behind us. And we were right through the German positions. We'd gone out 2,500 yards in line, and we were dug in. And we just went with a counterattack.
During the advance, moving forward, how are orders? Is the shouting going on? Can you be heard?
It's hard. Because remember, we've got a barrage that's exploding 100 yards in front of us, our own barrage. Plus the Germans firing over the top of our barrage into us. And then the Desert Air Force flying over the top, dropping bombs 2 or 3 miles in front. So a heck of a lot of noise. And light. Well, the skies are lit up with both very lights, shells exploding, and you name it.
Do you see and hear?
Continuous thunder of guns from behind.
Do you see and hear men falling and crying? And
Of course you do. But when you're in action like that, you haven't got time to say, sorry, Jack, or look at him. But not long into the action, our battalion headquarters had gone off the air. I could talk to the other companies, but I couldn't talk back to the battalion headquarters. By the way, when we'd gone into action, we had one of the leading BBC news commenters. Who was it now? Richard. He went forward to the battalion headquarters to give a run commentary for the BBC on tape on the Solomon action. And that can I think of his name? But he's one of the, and he was up there in an army in action. Anyway, we gradually lost one or two of the company. I think I was, when I finally got into my position, I could speak to three out of the five companies. That's including the support company.
Again, before we come to that, how do men physically advance in their own physical position? Are they crouched? Are they standing upright? Or are they running? Or
we could only advance 100 yards a minute. It was a slow plod. Remember that we were like infantry, used to advance 140 a minute marching, but we were only going forward at slow march pace.
Is there a desire to crouch so that you don't get it?
I mean, we'll fix bayonets. I wouldn't fix bayonets, I had a revolver. And we went forward like that. And of course, they didn't only have the regular 200 rounds of ammunition, they also had bandoliers slung around the neck, and quite a lot of them were carrying brain gun ammunition in pouches, you know, just to keep feeding the brain guns. And they would just keep moving forward and dropping down and firing ahead, moving forward and dropping down and firing ahead. Of course, not very easy to fire brain guns from the hip, although I've seen them done. So, we finished up with no communications, and it wasn't the next day I found out that our battalion headquarters had been hit, and both our wireless sets and seven of our singlers had been killed at battalion and singing office. The two wireless sets had been knocked out, and so there was only us. I think I finished up talking to another two companies when I dug in. And when I dug in, I wasn't anywhere near company commander. We were in our positions, we'd all dug in, but where our company commander gone to, I don't know. The company commander. But he'd gone up, and whether he'd run about the platoons, getting them dug in, you know, when we'd reached our, probably shouting that we'll get down, dig in. But anyway, next day, 6 o'clock in the morning, we're lying there, and our tanks advanced through our lines. Now, it was barely turning light then, and we heard this huge rumble, and through our lines came all these tanks, hundreds of them. I've never known such a big advance of tanks all in one go, the way they came through. Now, as they came through, the Germans already had been dislodged out of their forward positions. They had to dig in afresh or counterattack and try and get the positions back. And they knew that we were too strong for that. So, and we killed a lot of them too. I think we must have killed two to every one of our losses. I think that was about the average of the Alamein breakthrough. But a lot of them being killed by our artillery. 2,000 guns, creeping barrages. It's hellish, you know. It's the biggest barrage of the Second World War, that one. Except for maybe it's what the Navy put in Normandy. But anyway, that was the Alamein line broken. And our tanks went through. There was one or two panzer tanks that tried to get through. I saw a 9th Battalion sergeant run up the side of one, open a turret and sling a grenade in. Knew that sergeant because he already had an MM. No, he already had a DCM. He got a bar to that one. He had a MM, DCM, and bar. No, have you any idea who that sergeant was? Because there wasn't any DCM and bars in the drums. But I saw him do that. He threw up turret, dropped grenade, down turret, bang. That was the end of that, my four ton. You saw lots of actions like that, but they were just split second actions, you know. Just you're looking around in the same what was happening. You saw this tank coming, and thought, oh, yeah, this one's going to take a few out, and that happens. I suppose the sergeant, because he'd already had one medal, thought, well, I might as well have another, either that or be dead. But it's something that you just don't spur the moment, isn't it? You don't think about what you're doing. Anyway, we dug in and the tanks were in port. And all that day, 2nd of November 1942, the tanks went forward and forward, and gradually the armour piece and shells from the German tanks had been scuttling back and whizzing across the sand. And if any of them had hit, as you know, would have gone right through you. Armour piece and 88 millimetre armour piece and shells from the Germans. Right, so all during that day we were just lying dug over. Just had our 24 ration pack that we went into action with, our hot dog, biscuit, bully beef, and 2 pints of water. And we just lay there and wondering where our next move was to be, because we belonged to the signals, we thought, well, we've got to make our way back to battalion quarters. There was no, well, more or less, when we freeze within action, nobody told us what they had to do. So I got up, but I can't remember who the signaller was. I think it was Hubert Latham with me. And we went back. We went back to at the end of the day of November the 2nd. And we found ourselves in 8 battalion lines. They were stretched out along a sunken part of Wadi. And we asked if he could tell us where the 6th battalion were. And they said, oh, you're a little bit further to the right. So we went and we found our lines. But the troops were beginning to stand up and walk about. The tanks were fighting. The 7th Armoured, the Guards Armoured, they'd all moved forward. And the Germans were on the run. Their panzers had been overrun, and they were on the run. So I reported back to our battalion headquarters and found out what had happened to our... I took me a while to set back. Found out what had happened to our battalion headquarters sets. Wilf Holden was one of them that was killed. Wilf Holden was. He was the one that was supposed to be number one set back in headquarters, and he'd gone off the air, and that's what had happened. So that had been a heavy shell that coming back from the Germans. So we were reassembled, and battalion gradually were pulled back into battalion formation, and roll calls made. Stretcher parties went out and brought our own wounded and dead back. And the next day or so it was just more or less seeing what we had, what equipment we had left, and getting back into our company formations again.
What kind of messages had you been getting during the action and were sending?
Well, I was just saying that we'd as the company commander said, we've advanced 200 yards. 200 yards advance complete. 400 yards advance complete. See, I was close, I think it was Corporal Cairns of the intelligence section that was going along with me, making time. He later became Sergeant Cairns. And he was a Scotchman. And he was going forward, and so we knew exactly how far we'd advanced. He had a timer. And so all we were doing was just advancing, and then final positions dug in. But all I could say was send their messages back, hoping that somebody would receive them. You see? But in actual fact, there's only the next company that could hear me.
You can hear other companies talking, can you?
We were all on the same wavelength. In our battalion, we were said, before we go out into an action like that, we're all tuned in, each of those wirelesses tuned in, thought all wirelesses report in before we advance in. And then we advance on the same wavelength. We only change our wavelength when we're told to, it was every 24 hours. But we went forward, and I think I came back with the wireless, but only in communication with another telecom using it.
Are you given codes and code names?
Code names was general, which everybody used in the army. Suddenly I was the commander, whether it was a company commander, platoon commander, or commanding officer. Sunrear 2 was the second in command. So, and you had different code names like that. The only code name that we'd gotten from nowhere was the action murder, and we were given that. We were given that by when we went into Sicily. Before we went into Sicily, we were given that. If we wanted artillery action, but a shock murder, and given a code number, a map reference, and the action that we needed.